KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is John Rinn, an environmental blogger for grist.org and creator of manufacturinggreenprosperity.com. John holds a PhD in international relations from the City University of New York and was an adjunct professor of political science at Baruch College. John Rinn is here today to tell us about his newly published book, Manufacturing Green Prosperity, The Power to Rebuild the American Middle Class. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much.
What led you to write your book, Manufacturing Green Prosperity?
Well, I've always been very interested in why economic growth takes place. I always was sort of frustrated that that whole debate seemed to be dominated by the conservatives. And so I had the opportunity to work with Professor Seymour Melman at Columbia University, who I think was one of the great economic thinkers of the post-war period. And what I did was I came up with a theory and a framework for understanding why manufacturing is so central to the economy and what happens when manufacturing doesn't thrive and declines as it is in the United States. But then at the same time, I became very concerned about all the ecological crises going on, like global warming, things like the end of the era of cheap oil, other ecological disasters. And so I wanted to put those two ideas together and to argue that we need a long-term vision of how to pull ourselves out of both the ecological and the economic crises, and that by solving the two at the same time, we actually make things easier. That is, we can rebuild the society, rebuild the infrastructures so that we have some green sustainability, but at the same time, that would rebuild the manufacturing system. So it's really a very ambitious attempt to try and at least open up some sort of debate about how we can conceive of a long-term sustainable future.
Would you give a brief overview of why you think manufacturing is key to a healthy society?
Well, manufacturing has really for several hundred years been considered the main route to national wealth and power. That's why Alexander Hamilton talked about protecting infant industries. And the United States really became the world power, and in the 20th century was the American century, very much based on the fact that the U.S. had about 50% of the global market in the most basic part of the manufacturing sector, that is industrial machinery. And so it seems, at least on the face of it, if we look at the countries that do very well, like the United States, they have very strong manufacturing systems. And we've noticed that China has become a very important country, and not just because they're doing services, it's because they're doing manufacturing. But there's a deeper reason. There are a couple deeper reasons. One is that actually trade among countries is 80% in goods, not in services. So if you want to actually globalize, you have to be able to trade goods for goods. And for some reason, current economists can't seem to figure this out. So the U.S. is in a very vulnerable position, not being able to exchange goods for goods. We're exchanging dollars for goods, and I don't think that that's economically sustainable. And then the most fundamental reason, really, is that technological growth and innovation is really dependent on the most basic parts of the industrial structure, the critical technologies that when they change, they create whole new parts of our society, like the computer and the iPhone and the iPod. Those are all made possible by developments in a very strange little technology called semiconductor making equipment. And most people have more familiarity with those smokers at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean that they discovered a few years ago than they do with these rather obscure technologies, but they've been extremely important and critical to the growth and well-being of the whole society. So basically, if you look at the historical record, manufacturing is important. If you look at the way trade works and the way services are set up, they are dependent on manufacturing. Then most fundamentally, if you look at how growth actually occurs, it occurs through mainly through the manufacturing sector.
Would you say more about what has happened to the manufacturing sector of the U.S. over time?
Well, it's taken quite a decline. In 1970, 6% of what we consumed was imported from abroad. In 2007, 37% of what we consumed was imported from abroad. In 1970, about 25% of the workforce was in manufacturing, and now about 11% of the workforce is in manufacturing. And the same goes for the economy, which had about a quarter of it was involved with manufacturing, now only 11%. And interestingly, the shift of wealth from the top 1% during that period pretty much tracked the shift out of manufacturing. In other words, it seems like the top 1% went from, you know, about 10% of the GNP income to 25% at the same time the shift was happening. And it's sort of like they basically siphoned off the wealth-generating capacity of the United States. So, and also unions have fallen at the same rate of manufacturing. So it's been a really, to me, a rather catastrophic situation. Of course, now we have over 20 million people who are either unemployed or underemployed, and most of them would be employed if we simply were at the same levels of manufacturing that we were at in 1970.
What has caused the U.S. manufacturing system to decline?
Well, the work of Seymour Melman, M-E-L-M-A-N, he passed away in 2004, but he put out quite a few books in the 60s and 70s and in the 80s explaining why actually the military-industrial complex, although it seems like it might help the manufacturing sector, actually leads to its decline because it sort of pulls the best and the brightest into a system that is really the closest we have to the Soviet planned economy and all the inefficiencies of that. Of course, we are familiar with that. We now have socialism is alive and well in the Pentagon. And so that's done quite a bit to make the rest of the manufacturing sector sort of lose its competence, because making tanks and Air Force planes leads to really bad habits, and those spill over when you're trying to make civilian products. But there's also been other problems. The financial sector has gotten very big and has pushed the manufacturers to outsource and to move everything abroad of, you know, whole scale. And in the search for lower wages, Melman actually discovered that he could not find a single factory that shut down that was actually losing money. So, for instance, had all those factories been employee-owned and operated, none of them would have gone abroad, and they'd all be doing just fine. But the quest for short-term profits led to a short-term solution, which now is turning into a long-term catastrophe. So those are sort of two of the big problems that we face.
How do we compare with other countries in our manufacturing capabilities at present?
Well, in the critical sector that I was talking about earlier, the industrial machinery, where we used to dominate and we had like 50% of the global production, we're now actually behind China. We're at about 15%. China's at 16%. The most important countries in Europe together constitute about 22%, Japan about 20%. So we're sinking fairly quickly, not irrevocably. We could pick ourselves back up. And of course, there's nothing terrible with not being number one. It's just that it's sort of a bad trend. And the manufacturing is also slipping as the world percentage. And our exports in particular, we have a huge trade deficit. And what that means is that we have many more imports than exports. And we're not able to sell our stuff abroad because we're being outcompeted by Germany, Japan, and on the upper end, that is, they actually pay their workers more than we do, and on the lower end by China. So we're sort of squeezed in the middle. And in order to overcome that, we really need to have the government, I feel, intervene in an intelligent manner and create greater competence.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is John Wren, author of the book Manufacturing Green Prosperity, The Power to Rebuild the American Middle Class. And you are tuned to the Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In your view, why is a manufacturing sector needed for the existence of a middle class?
Well, basically, the countries that don't have a manufacturing sector are the ones that we consider poor. They're considered underdeveloped. The countries that are becoming richer, we call newly industrializing countries. That's because if you don't have a manufacturing sector, really all you're stuck with is selling your minerals and your forests and things like that. Americans seem to think they could sell their services, but as I said, it's very hard to sell services abroad because, in essence, services are what you do with manufactured goods, so you can't really sell them abroad that much. You have to actually do them at the place where you're having the service. So eventually, the United States could turn more into Latin America, basically, where you have a very concentrated upper class and you have selling raw materials. But without a manufacturing sector, you don't really have anything to exchange with the rest of the world, and eventually the rest of the world might not want to exchange things with you anymore. And so there's really no base for the middle class to survive on. So what I outline in the book is a very ambitious program to rebuild the manufacturing sector, and that could create tens of millions of good middle-class jobs, the kinds of jobs that are disappearing now.
How could a new manufacturing sector contribute to solving issues such as climate change and building a more sustainable world?
Well, one advantage of doing this is that we would know that we were actually solving the climate change problem. One of the problems with cap and trade and carbon taxes is that we don't really know how they would work. But if you actually built a high-speed train network across the country, we know that we could eliminate a large percentage of our need for oil. If you built a wind system across the country, an interstate wind system, and you placed the wind farms so that there was always wind blowing somewhere and they could provide electricity at any time, you know, you could replace the coal plants. If we worked to make buildings energy self-reliant by putting solar panels on them or something called ground source heat pumps below them to provide heating, and we did a lot of retrofitting, then we could eliminate a very large percentage of the energy and the natural gas that we need for buildings. And with all of those together, we could just about virtually eliminate the use of fossil fuels, which constitute about 60% of the climate change greenhouse gases globally. And there's a couple of other major areas that need to be changed. In order to really take advantage of trains, we have to have a rather dense urban structure. That is, for instance, you know, in Seattle and Portland and other cities are trying to encourage transit because the density of Seattle and Portland and other cities allows you to take advantage of transit. So we would have to encourage the building up of town centers, even the further densification of urban areas. And then the other major thing we'd have to do actually is transform the agricultural system to be more of a local, organic-based system so that we're not destroying the environment the way they are now and also releasing greenhouse gases in that sense. So if we actually built all of these systems, either the local ones, the building-oriented ones, the national ones, we could actually shoot for zero carbon emissions or something pretty close.
Would you say more about the development of electric trains?
Sure. High-speed rail, which are trains that really go about 200 miles an hour, are sort of really all the rage in most of the world, although most of the world is not as spread out as the United States. That is China and Europe and Japan, the developing world. And what these trains allow you to do is basically replace airplanes, certainly from about 500 miles or less. So, for instance, if we had high-speed rail between New York and Chicago, you could get there in 5 hours. And even across country, you know, it wouldn't take significantly longer, perhaps, than an airplane. But certainly between medium-sized routes, that those are all powered by electricity. Also, to convert the freight rail system to electricity, freight rail can be like a dozen times more energy efficient than trucks, those big long-haul trucks. And so that would be another way to decrease our energy use. Subways and light rail also use just electricity. And so they could be used in conjunction with electric cars, which a lot of people are interested in. But I don't know that electric cars will ever be able to go 300 miles, you know, whenever you want at 60 miles an hour. I think they'll always be somewhat short range and somewhat slow, which will be fine if, again, we densify the town centers and the city centers so that you can sort of drive around town, drive to your local train station, and then if you want to take a long trip, you would take it on a very comfortable, efficient, fast, high-speed train. So this would take, obviously, you know, a very large shift in people's thinking, but we made a huge shift after World War II into a car-oriented suburban structure, if people want to, and there's evidence that a lot of people want to. We could come back and take advantage of cities and walkable towns.
In your book, you speak about the need for government to help promote a robust manufacturing sector. Why is government needed?
Well, the market is remarkably unable to handle various problems. That doesn't mean that the government can do everything. The government should do what it does best, and the market should do what it does best. The market is particularly bad at dealing with long-term, system-wide problems such as climate change or such as transforming a transportation system. For instance, in the 1950s, the U.S. government, with Dwight D. Eisenhower behind it, the Republican president, started the construction of the interstate highway system because that was something that the private marketplace simply was unable to do. It was unable to plan out a system-wide system, and it was unable to come up with the capital to do it. But private firms built the interstate system, and private firms could build an interstate train system or an interstate wind system, but for designing and for financing such systems, really only the government can do something like that. But further, through the centuries, in the United States and certainly in East Asia and Europe, any country that has become wealthy, the government has encouraged its manufacturing firms to become better, and it's done that in various ways. Sometimes it's protected the market and wouldn't let products in or would charge a high tariff, but maybe a little better, it would create an education system, it would subsidize firms until they got on their feet, it would provide markets for those firms. It would say that's why something like an interstate rail system or wind system would provide a huge market for private firms to be able to lift themselves up and become world-class manufacturers. So there's all kinds of proven ways that the government can help the private sector. I don't know if you want to call the interstate highway system socialist, so be it. But, you know, Calvin Coolidge signed the legislation to build the Hoover Dam in the West that allowed all the western cities, Arizona and Nevada, which, you know, elect conservative politicians, wouldn't exist without the government having created a water system in the West. So it's sort of disingenuous for conservatives to say that the government can't solve problems. They've been doing it for centuries, and in order to solve our problems, they'll have to do it for centuries more.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is John Wren, author of the book Manufacturing Green Prosperity, The Power to Rebuild the American Middle Class. And you are tuned to the Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What steps would you recommend for our current government to take to help promote the manufacturing you propose?
Well, it would be difficult for the current government to do it because they're sort of enthralled to the big corporations. One of the reasons I wanted to put this forward was that I felt that maybe another strategy to pursue would be for progressives to try and come to some consensus about what kind of program they would like to see implemented. And then what they would do is they would say, okay, we will support candidates that support A, B, C, D, and E, well, that support these programs. And if you don't support them or you get into office, you don't support them, we'll support somebody else. So instead of having just somebody say, yes, we can, they'd have to say, yes, we can spend, you know, $200 billion a year constructing a high-speed rail system, a few hundred billion constructing a wind system, et cetera, et cetera. So we'd sort of be able to hold their feet to the fire. Assuming you could get a government then elected, I think they could just start to implement these big construction programs. And they would have to take place also with a good set of educational programs to bring workers up to speed. It would probably take bringing in foreign firms who know how to make these things better than we do bring them in and say, okay, you can build this stuff for us, but you have to teach us how to do it, which is exactly what Korea and Japan and China have done. They've said, sure, you can build stuff here, but you have to tell us how to do it. So, again, there's many ways that the government can get going. And, you know, what I want to contribute is the idea of thinking really big, I mean really big, and thinking of ways that we could just pass things like the interstate highway system and moving forward and creating the jobs that we need and making the economy sustainable ecologically and economically.
What things do you see happening outside of government that could help promote a sustainable manufacturing system?
Well, it would be nice if there are some companies that would profit from these systems. Like I noticed General Electric is getting more concerned about the loss of manufacturing, even though they've really encouraged a lot of it. There's some portion of the corporate sector there sort of starting to understand some of these ideas, so that would be good. I think, again, if people were just talking about and thinking about what kind of society they'd like to see in fairly concrete terms, what do they think a good society would look like, and how would a government help to construct that? Also, however, there are now currently going on thousands of local efforts all across the country and actually all around the world. Paul Hawken wrote a great book called Blessed Unrest about how all across the world there's millions of groups that are trying to protect the planet. So certainly continue the good fight at the local level. And then the great thing would be to link all these groups together to create something that could avert, all these ecological and economic crises.
What do you see as the greatest challenges to bringing about a more sustainable manufacturing sector and a more robust manufacturing sector?
Well, apparently the powers that be, particularly the financial sector, really enjoy the situation where they can make more money by shutting down a factory and sending it abroad. It's a very short-term strategy, so they would have to sort of reorient from that. There's also another important foundation to this, and that is a lot of the conventional economics really points in the direction of not giving any concern to the manufacturing sector. They sort of have this is the best of all possible worlds approach, and so you'll never hardly ever hear economists talk about how bad it is that the manufacturing sector is declining. It's not ideologically compatible with the worldview. So that's a very important sort of ideological barrier to understanding what's going on. So in my book, I actually propose an alternative paradigm for understanding economics. I talk about economics as an ecosystem where there are certain sectors or niches that are important and have to exist, like manufacturing, and they fit together in a certain way, and if they don't, then the whole system starts to collapse, and we should think of the economy as a set of functions or critical sectors that aren't necessarily determined by how much money they're making. It depends what they're doing. So there's ideological barriers, there's power barriers, there's the government now, the federal government, thinks its main job sometimes is to lord it over the rest of the planet with 700 military bases and fighting wars, so they have their eyes off the prize, basically. So between all of this, it can look very difficult to turn it around, but, I'm hoping that maybe, shedding light on the issue will make things turn around.
And what do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope that it will stimulate people to think about issues in a big way, in a systemic way. Maybe it'll encourage other authors to say, well, if he can do something like that, I can do something like that, and envision a bright future, really. I think one of the problems that progressives have now is it's been 30 years of bad news, and so it tend to not believe that we can come up with an exciting future that people could be attracted to. I mean, what happened in the elections, for instance, was the Democratic Party had nothing to say about how to turn the economy around. And even though the Republicans were basically saying, we're going to make it worse, at least they said something. And so, particularly in the economic realm, we need to come up with some very concrete plans. And I hope that people think about the government as an entity that can build things, not just simply spend money. not something that can only fight wars, but an entity that can actually build things. And that, I think, would be a more concrete way of talking about job creation and perhaps lead to a better outcome in the coming elections.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'd like to leave your listeners with some hope. Times can seem really frustrating, but it turns out, I think, that the physical, the technological, actually even the economic realities of the world point to solutions that we can create. And so the problem is more of a political problem. It's more of a social or sometimes even a cultural problem. But it's important to know that the solutions are out there, that while it's very important to understand all the problems and all the political obstacles, it's also very important to understand what is possible. And so I hope I can push the envelope on what people think is possible.
Well, thanks so much for being here, John.
Well, thank you very much.
You have just been listening to John Rinn, author of the book Manufacturing Green Prosperity, The Power to Rebuild the American Middle Class, published in 2010 by Prager Publishers. For more information, check on the web at www.manufacturinggreenprosperity.com. Again, that's manufacturinggreenprosperity.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.